DZUP Special Features.
Speaker ay nasasabi natin sa mga alam dito sa lingkungan nila dahil sa kanyang expertise, lalo sa mga alaman at dito. Susunod po ay ating speaker ay si Dr. Grace Ogaldebora. Isa po siyang professor sa ating Department of Arts and Communication. Ituturo siya ng Communication of Philippine Arts at marami po siyang publication sa mga academic journals. So, hindi na po namin mabilang ito. Kanyang mga accomplishments. He's also a performing artist. Mananayo po siya. So, ang susunod po natin, bigyan po natin yung masigawang palakpakan si Dr. Grace Ogaldebora.
So, good afternoon. I will try to make it fast because I have 10 stories, so I will not give the details of the stories, just storylines.
Just storylines, no? And so the point is there must be a basis for the conclusion later on, okay? So let's start. So the problem seeks to study folk memories and on disaster as projected in selected Philippine traditional narratives, to connect them with the present experiences of disasters and possibly climate change, and propose a policy or two for government action in line with disaster response and even preparation. So they're not necessarily the major themes. Disasters are not usually the major themes in the story. Some of them are minor, some disasters are just incidental, but I gave them some kind of mention anyway because of their importance, no? Let's go. So to realize the above objective, the following action would be made. First, there's a pattern that I use: identify the kind of disaster indicated in each selected narrative. Second, extract the human interpretation of the disaster based on text, not our interpretation but the people's interpretation as revealed in the text, so that we can see how they made sense of the event. So third, to identify the effects, results of that disaster. And fourth, identify the human response to the disaster if ever indicated or evoked. Sometimes there's no given response. It's just a description. Then, based on the data compiled, analyzed and interpreted from the selected traditional narratives, based on items given above, a conclusion on past disasters should be made and would be connected to modern contemporary disasters as a wisdom learned from the past in terms of disaster. Furthermore, a suggestion or two would be given for policy formulation. So there are three kinds of natural disasters. As research, geological, triggered by internal workings of the earth; meteorological, caused by variations in global weather patterns; and biological disasters, resulting from actions of living agents like diseases or insect pests, and they can occur separately or together. So I would indicate combination. And this is based on the book, Natural Disasters by Paul Turner. Forms of natural disasters, well, some of them are in the stories. Volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, tsunamis, drought, famine, hurricane, flood, avalanche, plague, epidemics, pestilence, wildfire, forest fire, hurricane, typhoons. So the legend, let me now hurry to the first, the legend of the Balete Tree, story from Palawan. So there was a mention of the global deluge. And it was believed that the early people lived in big trees. So there was one a couple. Their parents were not amenable to the relationship, so they elope and into the forest and tried to live in a huge balete tree. But there came a time when there was this huge flood, and there was a belief that all the other living creatures died except the people who lived under the balete tree. So that's a belief. So you would be surprised. But I will be expanding the time if I do this. But a balete tree can be used as a household. And now, okay, so the people who live under the huge tree were saved from the flood. So all living creatures were drowned except those living under the balete tree. Response, it became the sacred tree for the pre-colonial Filipinos who believe it to be the home of their Nuno or ancestors. Their ancestors became invisible guardians of the sacred tree. Well, if you can observe the balete tree, it can be seen as a house. But now it's known as the house of spirits. But it was not like that before. So, well, this is in Sikihor, this is in Aurora. And then you can have this. There's a cave inside a big balete tree. So you can imagine how people would live in such a place. Okay, so in the Ifugao flood myth, there were two forms of disaster: drought and flood, a deluge. So the drought came first because after the place was like experiencing a golden age, there were abundant food, people were happy, satisfied. Suddenly the rain did not just come. So and everyone, the river was getting dry, and so the people tried to do something about it because they were dying. So they said, let's dig up the grave of the river, meaning to say there's always what you call matanang tubig. So if that is really the root of the water, if you strike it, and true enough in the story, one struck it and there was endless gushing of water and some people drowned in the process. But so they were somehow, if you just read in between the lines, if you just read it literally, you will not really see why the gods punished them, because they believed that they were punished by the gods. Why? Because, result, they did not ask permission from in digging the river. So all living things died except for a brother and sister. After that disaster flood, they did not ask permission from the river spirit that they would dig it. So in the past, you cannot do anything without asking permission from the spirit. So there was a great flood, only a brother and a sister who went up the mountain facing each other were able to survive. With the continuous drainage, with the continuous rain for months, the water rose and the earth drainage was blocked. There's a hole in, there is a sacred geography for the earth in early times, and they said that the earth, the water disposed themselves into the earth through the hole. That may cause flooding if it is blocked. Response, flood was a punishment for lack of respect for guardians of nature. The coming of drought was not explained. It just came. It seemed to be just a factual, a given thing. So it didn't rain, and so people became, for the first time, they became worried. There's a part in the story when there was again a problem with fertility. There was an impending drought, and again there was supposed to be another flood. So they anticipated that and gave a sacrifice. It didn't work for the rat, it didn't work for chicken, it's the other. So they ended up giving human sacrifice. It was effective, but the gods told them that because of that, they sacrificed a human being, they would always have war within them. So although the human sacrifice was effective, it was not really endorsed by the gods. So from there on, they recommended chicken and pig for sacrifice. So I would call saved by the mountains, because if you see, look at the rice terraces, there are actually mountains, and if there is a big flood, you could really run to the top. Okay? So Angalo and Aran from the Ilocos region, there was a combination of deluge and other disasters. Okay, yes. There was a quarrel between two giants. So they were walking from the Ilocos to Sulu, and they were just wading, because that would seem that they're not only giants, but at that time probably the sea level was not that deep, so that high. So that's why they quarreled when they reached Sulu Sea. They found so many pearls, and they quarreled over. Later on, they gathered the pearls that they could get. When they reached the Visayas Islands, going back to Ilocos, they quarreled over the pearls, the division of the pearls. And so because of their fighting, it created so much turbulence and chaos around that the islands gave way. So you can read in between the lines what's happening here scientifically, different from the story. So there was some kind of displacement in the ground of the earth. So what would cause the islands to be broken, the great land mass to be broken into islands? You can just imagine, there could be earthquake, there could be some cataclysms there, but it's just a description that is just inserted there. But there's a disaster, and this disaster is caused by the giants quarreling. Well, that is the metaphoric interpretation, but there is also a scientific interpretation. So the result is the breakup of the Visayan land into islands and islets. Response, attribution of non-human events and actions affecting the earth and human beings. This time, the quarrel of among the giants. And that's also Angalo, who would be actually throwing his bahag deep into the sea. So the bahag would absorb so much water, and the level of the sea would become low. But when he would pick up the bahag again and try to squeeze it, then all the water from the bahag will fall down upon the sea. So it would make the sea level rise once again. So these are metaphorical events, but they have some kind of empirical repercussions. So, well, they are data that explain empirical happenings explained metaphorically by people. So, legend of Pawai Lake, there is a great flooding, and it was believed that was a trading area, and people became affluent. They had, according to the story, they had gold. So they had gold, but then they became very proud. And so flooding was considered to be a punishment. So there are two. The first version involves kindness to strangers, the lack of kindness to an old woman. So she was not given any food. And so after the woman was not treated well, then there was the sudden rain without let up, and it drowned the whole community. That's why you don't have the Pawai Lake. In another version, there's another flooding caused by the disrespect of a sacred woman leader. Because she was just a woman, she was attacked by a powerful warrior, but actually she was like a babaylan. She was a leader babaylan. So, and she was beautiful, but she never wanted to marry. So one day, one of her wooers was rejected by her, planned to attack her so that when she is defeated, he would forcibly marry her. But upon seeing her figure lying helpless there, she was actually meditating. When he was about to approach her, suddenly there was a great flashing of lightning, and there was heavy downpour, and it never really stopped for how many months. So at the end, the whole palace was was flooded was all under the sea. And people still think up to now, they see unusual things in the lake. They see sometimes images of building structures beneath it. And they said that the fish that they find there have earrings. And they have very unusual. So it's like na-encanto. I said, okay. So, okay, you have this is Pawai Lake. So the legend of Mount Arayat and Candaba Swamp, the form of disaster is a combination of many elements because there, of course, there is the creation of the swamp because the giant, one, they did not like the way people treated the mountain. So he got one night, he just lifted the mountain and then carried it behind his back and moved it to a place not really far away, but still nearby. And so the next morning, there was no mountain anymore. Mount Arayat has been transferred to the present location of Arayat. And the place where Arayat disappeared became a swamp, Candaba Swamp. So here is the, they're just nearby within the, you can see within sight, that's the Candaba Swamp. Okay, so that's, and above is the mountain of Arayat. So the legend of Bai, there's also flooding there, drowning the church and the community. So there was actually a conflict between the Babaylan, who became a Christian, three women. They inherited the leadership from their Datu Pangil, and then the local priest, the missionary priest. So in the process, the priest want, they actually in the morning, they would go to the lake to bathe in the lake, the waters of the lake, and be bathing under the light of the sun. So that's a ritual.
Pagyamanin ang kaalaman tungkol sa iyong kalusugan at maging handa laban sa anumang karamdaman dahil ang kalusugan mo ay mahalaga. Your health matters. Tuwing Martes, alas 4 hanggang alas 5 ng hapon, Health Matters. Dito lang sa DZUP 1602, kasali ka.
DZUP Special Features.
That's a ritual. It's not mentioned, but that's a ritual of sunbathing and homage to the sun. After that, they will be required to go to the church. So they told the priest, don't stop until we arrive at church because we are still doing our morning ritual. But then one day, the priest didn't want to wait. So he started the mass. And so he castigated the three women leaders who came late, which I actually got the ire of the people. So the people decided to imprison the priest in the town. And so at the end, well, he was released at the end of the day. But then he boarded a banca with fishermen who were coming home from fishing the whole night. But then he said, okay, don't look at me. He started mumbling words that it was, you can interpret these mumbling words as like Latin. He was angry and he threw away one of his sandals. And the moment he threw away his sandal, there was this big banging sound and the waters arose. And at the end, everyone survived except the priest. And I what is the source of this? So this is like, you can interpret this in the colon as neo-colonial, I mean, in a post-colonial way, that the people took it against the priest, but in the end, it was the priest who died. But in another version, actually, the curse was given by the three sisters, Mariang Sinukuan, Mariang Makiling, and Mariang Sinukuan Makiling, and Banahaw, because they cursed the Bae. Bae was cursed as a town because they changed their love for the mother goddess into a new religion. So that's why they say, because of the flooding, the three Marias each went to their own mountains. So Maria Sinukan went to Arayat, Maria Makiling to Makiling, and Maria Banahaw. So, but anyway, so up to now, people in Bae believe that if you are a local resident, you will not succeed in business. And it will be, but only the migrants succeed in business, according to them. But I don't know what will change the condition of Bae. Well, going back to the three Marias, or what? I don't know. That is the unstated conclusion there. So anyway, so that is the pulo ng Bae. It's drowned. It's just partially shown. I've been there. It's full of balete trees and big rocks. And they said that it used to be connected to the pulo. The shoreline of the barangay used to be connected to the pulo. And so, but they said that is, some people interpret that pulo as the former site of the church. And I began to wonder, is it really a Catholic church or is it an ancient water temple? I believe it could be an ancient water temple that was only Christianized into a drowned church. Well, this needs further study. The legend of cockfighting, I got this from residents of, my student had this, is from Pampanga, and the person she interviewed was actually my friend. And my friend really is a folklore expert. So he said that Munag Sumala was actually in the form of a snake, but she was the Pampanga River. She had an illicit relationship with the sea god, who appeared like a monster, a crocodile, half human. And so, but then Manalastas was the husband in the form of a rooster. So Apo Sinukuan, the husband went to Apo Sinukuan to inform the father about the misdeeds of his wife. He could not confront his wife. Anyway, so the Apo Sinukuan said, you should refrain from seeing the sea water, the god of the water. From now on, don't do it. So, as the river, the Pampanga River, she was so sad. And so there was no more water coming from the mountains. And there was no longer water coming from the sea. That was the territory of the sea god. And so the people decided they were dying because of pestilence. And so they knew what was the reason. So they sacrificed the rooster. Earlier, it was sacred. The rooster was sacred and you should not sacrifice the rooster. But for their survival, they had to sacrifice the rooster. And it was the beginning of cockfighting. There was a sacrifice involved. So from there on, the water from the Manila Bay entered again the Pampanga River. So actually, there's a meeting of the salt waters and the fresh water coming from the mountain through the mouth of the Pampanga River draining into the Manila Bay. So sometimes it would go inland. So that is the reason why. So there's like a relationship between the seawater and the goddess of the river. So it was actually just a graphic, the geography of the land, the terrain of the land that was created, that created the story. So the second, there was the phenomenological, empirical fact of the layout of the land. So, that's a Pampanga River. The legend of the Salinas Salt Spring from Nueva Vizcaya, that's the second to the last. There was also a deluge because the water, the sea sympathized with a lover who was killed by a traitor. And so the wife who loved the husband buried him top on top of a mountain. Then she cried there and then cried and cried. And so probably the tears were salty. And then until the sea sympathized with her. And there was one deluge that reached up to the mountain. And then reached the height of that grave. And so they believed that that grave was really the salt spring. It's really, okay, it's like this. That's the salt spring, but now it's gone. It's like this already because it was destroyed by the earthquake in the 1990s. And so the description was this one. This is a huge rock made of like salt. There was salt in it. And according to the reports, I haven't really seen it in fact, but in actual fact. But the reports say that when it was still not destroyed, it would periodically let water steam come up, water vapor, and then there would be smoke, heavy smoke around that area. So, and then it's full of salt that would come, salt would come out. So I would, what is this empirically? So it would appear probably, it's just a hypothesis that the sea has an underground tunnel that is connected to the top of the mountain. So, but probably there's also some kind of gas there anyway. So from time to time, it would erupt in a gas steam with smoke, and it would emit, let's say, the salt, and it would become like this later on. But it's a geological phenomenon. No? And they created a story out of that empirical fact. Lastly is the Ebalon Bicol fragment. This is just a detail. According to the verses. So there was this coming of three patriarchal leaders, and then the second one okay, created some kind of civilization. Then after creating that civilization there, then these are now the lines. And then came the flood brought by Onos, the god of the storm, that everything on land was completely transformed. The volcanoes erupted, Hanti, Colasi, Isarog, and at the same time was felt a great earthquake. So great was the catastrophe that the sea left dry, the isthmus of Pasakaw in the state it is today. From the continent was separated the island of Malbogon, where died the Sibyls, called Hilan Laryong. These are esoteric names now. The great waters of Inarihan, its course to the east chains, which before the cataclysm has emptied into Ponon. In Bato, now this is the reference to the drowned lake. In Bato was submerged a great mountain, and its place appeared the lake, which now nourishes Ibalon with its fish. It's like the phenomenon of the Candaba Swamp, but this is Lake Bato. From the Gulf of Calabagnan disappeared the Gatnon, the place of the Dumagat, who inhabited Kotmon. Are these the Dumagats? I mean, the Aitas living there. Oh, well, this is the image of Lake Bato. Okay. So analysis, and all 10 traditional narratives of disaster involve flooding. flooding is sometimes preceded by drought or dryness. Indigenous pre-colonial folk people basically look at disasters as a response or reaction from the gods, or if not from the gods, due to some activities of gods affecting humans. Myths, so I also subscribe to the belief that myths, legends, folk stories appear not just to be carriers of archetypal images and symbols, but are disguised indicators of some historical, geological, meteorological events. So you can also look at myth that way. It's not history, but they are indicators of some historical occurrences, embellished into stories by people involving the gods, demigods, or ordinary people. Myths can be sources of local wisdom, an intangible heritage of the past, to make us understand the present and move on further to the future. But you should not take everything in the myth literally. So you have to study language, history, culture in order to to get the language, to understand and see the wisdom hidden in the myths. Narratives are sources of poetic and symbolic wisdom, liberating us from the narrow vision of the literal truth about a rich multiple levels of reality. Because in the scientific world, you must say precisely, concisely, and only with one meaning. But in the worlds of myths and poetry, the more a sentence can mean many things, the better. That's a world of symbols. But in the world of science, you must exactly mean what you say in the most clear way. And so that becomes narrow. The world, the perception of the world becomes narrow. So for policy formulation, the government must institute the philosophy and ideology of pakikipagkapwa sa kalahatan as a guiding principle in its dealing with nature, natural and human resources, as a new paradigm for development and survival. Because if you look into myths, you can see that the indigenous peoples have nature as kapwa. They always look at nature as kapwa, as a living organism worthy of respect, and not just an object to be studied. There are also beings, according to living behind empirical empirical objects. They say, so that's how the subject to, the scientists don't believe that. But anyway, in the curriculum and training courses from the highest to the lowest levels, the philosophy and practice of pakikipagkapwa with nature needs to be enforced and instituted. You don't have to believe in spirits, but you also can look at these forces as living forces, energies that would need to be treated not as the other, but as our kapwa. Not as an object to be used for our own benefit, because there is actually a connection. So there is an web of interconnectivity. So for the conclusion, the focus is not here. The conclusion actually is climate change can also be seen, revealed in myths. Not all myths of disaster should reveal climate change. But apparently in some stories, there are just cycles of disasters happening. So if we look back at our myths, we can see that some of them are happening. For instance, nature is periodic and regular in its course, but all of a sudden it would go haywire, like chaos theory. It would just go haywire. And that's an indication that there is a change, great change happening. And that can be an indication of climate change. So if we are not aware of these things, so that it's actually an indication that there must be a paradigm shift in our consciousness. These are indicators in our greed for wealth. We actually destroy our earth. And once it's destroyed, gone is the human race. It's so easy to just destroy the earth. And with the destruction of the earth, there will be a new life again, probably, but it would certainly not be human beings, I believe. It would take years again to have human beings. So human beings actually became, civilizations happened, was achieved because the climate became more regular. So climate stabilized. But once you disrupt the balance of forces, well, there will be a great disaster because an imbalance has been committed. So for the forces to become more balanced, there is a great change to occur, and it might involve more lives being, you know, killed. So to avoid that, probably we have to be consciously changing our paradigm in relation to nature. So thank you.
Ito na ang programang kukumpleto sa Webes nyo.
Yun!
Tampok ang mga boses, kwento at talento ng ating mga kawani, reps at mga guro ng bayan.
Yun!
Tara na at pakinsa sa usapan para sa isang pamantasan at bansang masaya, masigla, malaya, makamamamayan at makabayan. Para sa isang tatakbon nyo na usapan, Union! Tuwing Huwebes, alauna hanggang alas dos ng hapon, dito lang sa DVD 1602, kasali ka!
Isang araw, di pa uwi na nga ako. Pagkabukas ko ng pinto, wala na akong ibang nakita. Hindi ang mga kamay niya na tumatama sa mukha ko. Wala na akong ibang naririnig, kundi ang iyak ng mga anak ko. Wala na akong ibang hinihiling, kundi matapos na ang lahat ng to.
Itigil ang pang-aabuso sa mga kababaihan. Isang paalala mula sa DZUP 1602. Kasali ka!
DZUP Special Features.
Yung susunod nating tagapagsalita ay si Celia Bonilla, no? Si Celia Bonilla ay katuwang na profesor sa UP Manila, kung saan siya nagtuturo ng humanities, Philippine Arts at Organizational Communication. Nagtapos siya ng MA Art Studies sa UP Diliman, kung saan kasalukuyan din niyang tinatapos ang kanyang PhD sa Philippine Studies. So magsasalita siya tungkol sa Quiapo Church Cultural Heritage Before and After World War II. So, mga kaibigan, pakinggan po natin si Professor Celia Bonilla.
Magandang umaga po o maghahapon na, magtatanghali na. Magandang tanghalian po. Well, to go straight to the point, no, Quiapo Church has had its share of disasters, both man-made and acts of nature. And through all these centuries, it had withstood these calamities, and thanks to the resilience and perseverance of the people, it has been serving. Okay, as the proverbial mute witness to people's lives, both individual and collective, both silent and noisy, internal and external. You know, Quiapo has one of the most phenomenal, you know, most na phenomenal pa, of show of devotions, no, all over the world. And I don't know if you're familiar, no, with their with what was done, no, every January 9, no, yung matinding mammoth procession. Now Quiapo was initially a district of islets. Now ito parang Inisip ko, sigurado, kasi nakita ko to doon sa Quiapo, among the Quiapo photo buckets. No? Pero parang binondo, di ba? Minsan, titingnan natin yung mga nakalagay sa internet, no? So we have to be more discerning. Then we can also say, okay, I got it from photo buckets, and then bucket. ganun siya. At any rate, no, it's one of your earthquake baroque churches. And so Quiapo was in that district of islets. Lahat tayo dito, no? Kaya Maynilad, kasi Maynila, it's all also the water lily. And then Quiapo is the water cabbage. Now, before it became a town in its own right, it was part of Santa Ana de Sapa, a Franciscan mission town in 1578. On August 29, 1586, Governor General Santiago de Vera granted the petition of Franciscan Prelate Superior, Saint Peter Baptist, San Pedro Bautista, who was to be martyred in Japan, no? To make Quiapo a separate town. The Franciscan prelate designated Father Antonio de Denombella as the first curate of the new parish. In 1592, a church of thatch and bamboo, nipa, no, and cane, dedicated to St. John the Baptist, was among the first extramuros churches, meaning outside of intramuros. That is, trade picked up as an offshoot of the evangelization initiated by the Franciscans, led then by the Franciscans and succeeded by secular priests, then for 3 years by Jesuits, and henceforth carried out by diocesan priests. The Quiapo Church suffered its first disaster in October 1603, when Sun Tai, you know, in Sun Tai Rebellion, a Chinese gardener led an uprising throughout the district of Quiapo and burned the church. It was rebuilt using stronger materials of Nara and stone. Nilagay ko yan para maintindihan natin how this very old structure has had so many phases, no, of its life. Okay? And then it became a secretariat, so it became bigger. But again, on November 30, a killer quake leveled it to the ground, no? Sabi nga ni Sir, no? Hindi natin maaalis yung mga terremoto, no? Kasi, you know, we are in the typhoon belt, and we're also in the rim of fire, or ring, no? So may ring na tayo, may belt pa. In 1662, another event threatened to destroy the church. It was among the structures marked for demolition, no, by authorities to prepare for the impending invasion of Koksen, the king of Formosa. Fortunately, and even miraculously, authorities spared it, but other churches like those in Malate and Ermita were not so lucky. Probably because it was across the Pasig. Hindi na siya strategic, no, if the invasion is coming from Manila Bay. In 1771, another quake caused even greater damage. And in 1791, fire broke out again. By this time, the Black Nazarene had been turned over to Quiapo. Now, the Black Nazarene is, of course, a life-sized statue of Jesus Christ, usually genuflecting on the left knee. Kaya alam, may nakita ako na nakatayo siya. Minsan, sa kanan ng knee. Genuflecting on the right knee. So there are different poses. But the one that came from Mexico now was on the genuflecting on the left knee. No, of course it has its own story. Like people didn't want to go back. No, the galleon crew didn't want to go back through the Pacific Ocean, which was anything but Pacific at that time. So what they did was to ask. The captain, no, in behalf of the crew, asked for the image, no, to be brought along with them. Sinamahan sila, no, ayun. So And anyway, I'll cut short that description. No, it's of dark wood made even darker. Now, hindi totoo, it's not true that the image is of ivory and only got burned. Because if the ivory gets burned, it doesn't get dark. Okay? So it's definitely of iron wood or kamagong. Now, the Nazarene came to us via Manila-Acapulco trade in 1606 when the officers and crew stranded of a stranded galleon brought it along from a church in Mexico. Okay, yun, we talked about it na. Now, in 1863, another earthquake devastated and even more, had even more substantial damage to the church. But it was not until 26 later that repairs and reconstruction could start under Father Eusebio de Leon, completed under Father Manuel Rojas in 1898. Okay, so it takes a while, no, for it to be funded. But you know what? There's a saying, as supercilious as a Spaniard, because they keep their records always, no? I don't know, pero siguro yung iba na wala na lang. Pero when I was researching in Arzobispado, they had all records, no? Mga talagang in that old script pa, no? I mean, not the old script as in Baybayin, no? But the escribiente style, no, of writing. Of course, it was in Spanish, so it's very good to learn Spanish. Now, the Nakpil design. On October 31, 1929, fire hit once again when an electrical spark landed on a curtain, lapping up the entire structure within minutes. The parish priest, Father Magdaleno Castillo, set up a parish committee headed by Doña Encarnacion Nakpil de Orense. So, sino to? This is the one of the daughters, no, of Gregoria and Julio Nakpil, to raise funds for the reconstruction of the church. And the parish priest commissioned their brother, Juan Nakpil, to design the new church. Nakpil's design was a cruciform, so Latin cross, with a canopy, no, the baldaquino, over the black Nazarene, no, yung makikita nyo ngayon. Okay, he raised the altar by a meter, even donating the altar base. He added a dome, a sacristy, and another bell tower. Of course, later he became national artist, no, for architecture. And the National Historical Commission of the Philippines classified the style as classic and set a marker on it to indicate that the church is an important architectural heritage. It was this structure that toughed out the years during the war, which started on January 2, 1942. Doon pumasok ang mga Hapon, no? Probably for fear, the people did not hold the yearly January 9 procession. So the Japanese just came in January 2. No, siyempre, they could not hold the January 9 procession of the Black Nazarene. Though the Japanese did not ban the procession, the 3 years of occupation were marked by hardship and privations. Ayan. No, ayan. The Japanese occupation. Ayan. That's the Capo Church, 1833, with renovation of Juan Nakpil. No? And then, ito, I want you to...
Great explosions cut short our memories. We knew that Yamashita had requested instructions from Tokyo.
Of course, that this is when was Tokyo's the destruction actually happened. Ayan. If you'll notice, there were some memorare, no, memorials for people killed, civilians killed during the war all around Manila, Intramuros, Adamson University. I just want you to see this for a short time. Okay, short. Okay, because I'm about to come. Excuse me. Thank you. the Intramuros.
It is January 9, 1945. The Filipino-American forces finally land in Blue Beach, Dagupan, in Mingayen. Preparations are being made to take back the city of Manila from Japanese Imperial forces. The Philippine capital has been occupied for 3 years and 7 days. Field Marshal Douglas MacArthur plans a two-pronged pincer attack. His forces are to enter the city from the north and south. He is hoping for a peaceful surrender of the city, but General Tomoyuki Yamashita, commander of the Japanese forces in the Philippines, has no intention to declare Manila an open city. They are prepared to die for the last man. Meanwhile, due to extreme inflation, the city has been suffering from starvation. There is a sense of abandonment and confusion and a breakdown of peace and order. The Filipino-American forces begin their march southward to Manila as guerrillas help liberate the surrounding towns. The countdown to liberation begins. January 21. Units of the U.S. 14th Corps alongside Filipino guerrilla troops under Major General Oscar Griswold start their advance to Manila. Earlier. U.S. forces led by Major General Joseph Swing and the Hunters ROTC, the famous Filipino guerrilla unit under Colonel Eleuterio Arevoso, advance to Manila from the south. The highly tense city awaits. Japanese death squads have already begun committing atrocities in some parts of the city. On the same day, Northern Force liberates the Malacañang Palace. The University of Santo Tomas was liberated next.
Yeah, we'll just, maybe some other time we'll see it. But then, yeah.
The Japanese use all means at their disposal to stop the American advance. Meanwhile, the Southern Force faces fierce resistance, which delays what would have been a simultaneous attack on the north and both fronts. Several Japanese soldiers also took hold of the Great Eastern Hotel's upper level and shoot at civilians and soldiers on the ground indiscriminately. The next day, the Japanese set fire to commercial areas in Manila, causing panic among the civilian population. The streets have been barricaded. Electricity has been cut off. The food supply is quickly depleting. Field Marshal MacArthur finally enters Manila and visits the...
Okay, now though the Japanese, the sacred statue of the Nuestra Señora de la Paz, y Buen Viaje, Buen Viaje, Our Lady of Peace and Good Voyage, was brought to Quiapo for safekeeping from its cathedral in Antipolo. And the image of the Black Nazarene was also for a time removed from the church and brought to the Nakpil House, the Bahay Nakpil, two streets across, also for safekeeping. Now that is why, I don't know, maybe you would hear how every April 30, the image of the Buen Viaje would viaje all the way to Quiapo and then leave the place at after the 6 p.m. Mass to go back to Antipolo on May 1. No, because it has been a tradition. It's like her visiting her son, but of course it was really for safekeeping. Even now, I would see youth walking, through Ortigas all the way, to the church to bring her back. Now, the Antipolo Cathedral, on the return of the Americans who had bombarded the Japanese forces, who ensconced all over the place, structures, especially the Intramuros, were leveled to the ground. The Japanese had also conducted, they call this the scorched earth tactics to inflict the worst damage that as they retreated, killing civilians, burning homes and churches. Okay? The Antipolo Cathedral was completely demolished. Luckily, they brought the Our Lady to Quiapo, by the returning Americans. But the Quiapo Church was miraculously spared, though all around it, like the Quezon Bridge you saw earlier, and even the convent nearby, was razed to the ground. For some unknown reason, the Japanese took down from the belfries the anti-air raid guns that would have made the church a perfect target for American forces. This was according to my grandmother, who, though weak from major surgery in CI, Cancer Institute then, was so updated thanks to also to my grandfather. Now, the war was indeed a way beyond the previous catastrophes for the church and the Quipenses, no, the people of Quiapo. But it was also a time for Filipinos to be more helpful and resourceful. Because after the war, as we reeled from the devastation and buried our dead, the Americans let go of us, that is, gave our independence at the time when we were most in need, no? And then we saw old surplus jeeps, no? The old Willie, no? The GI jeeps, and then that became the jeepney. And Plaza Miranda became the test area for one's political views. This was when the likes of Rudy Paar, a businessman with bigger faith, grew his business, no? He was himself a smuggler. But anyway, he became a very devout, he would go to the Nazarene, no? And help the church. He had 10 heart attacks until finally he was called, no? For real, no? By God, no? So he's now there. No, with him. Here he is shown wiping, no, as a privileged area. And then, ayan. And then, ayan. And then, here, of course, you have what I was talking about, no, such a phenomenal show of devotion. Okay? And a great social leveler, because here you have businessmen with, I interviewed a businessman, a president of his company from Ateneo, a doctor who is a, here in PGH, no, also a devotee. And then, of course, you have ex-convicts, politicians, everyone else, no, would be there, no, one helping each other to go up the Black Nazarene. Okay, so it's all in a bind in the procession. Okay, thank you for listening.
Napahinggan natin ang mga pag-aaral ni na Dr. Grace Odaldevora at Professor Celia Bonilla mula sa UP Manila Department of Arts and Communication sa idinaos na The Lost and the Retrieved, Built Cultural Heritage Amidst Conflict, ito sa DZUP Special Features. Hinandog ito sa atin ng UP Manila Philippine Arts Program. Ako si Gian Libro, magandang umaga.